Monuments are something we live our life around. They can be found in parks and important locations in history, by the side of the road and, of course, inside our cemeteries. Their purpose? To make memory solid in the eyes of the public. But what's it like to be an artist whose works bring a memorial to life? Theodore Adorno once said, "To write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric." How then can a piece of public art navigate that fine course between remembrance and representation of our tragedies? Janet Lawrence is a visual artist whose work focuses on matter and materials and how they evoke memory. She's something of a memorial maestro, having been commissioned to work on the Australian War Memorial in London and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Canberra. Andrea Goldsmith is an author and a monument enthusiast. A chance trip through an art installation planted the seeds in her mind for her most recent book, The Memory Trap, which followed the life of Nina Jamison, a fictional memorial consultant. Welcome to Weekend Arts, Janet and Andrea.
Thank you.
Hello.
Janet, let's start with you. As an artist, where does the concept for a memorial begin? And why don't we use the Australian War Memorial in London as an example?
I was really invited into the team by the architects, and we had already worked together on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. So that had been a competition, and the Australian War Memorial also was a competition, so I entered into that with the team, and really we developed the whole idea of it very much together, it over a very long period. I think in every case it's very different. You know, the London one, as I said, it evolved very, very slowly. A lot of discussion about where it was, the form it could be, the materials within it, the content it has to embody. And, you know, there were about four of us sort of really discussing it, you know, a lot, and trying to understand how it would feel in that site. And I think that's one of the most important things, is to think about the experience of the materials in that very place.
What is it that you bring to the table in these negotiations and in the preparation for this memorial that the architects are unable to do?
In the case of that particular work, once we had got its sense of being on that site, the sense of its almost geological belonging to that park and then to the city beyond, somehow the other things fell into place. I mean, already you're being given a certain meaning you have to work with. You still have to create that meaning through the way the materials are used, through the way the content is revealed. And it was really through brilliant graphic designers who were able to devise. Obviously, we'd already thought about the idea of having the names of places rather than people. And the names of places have incredible, they evoke very different things, and they open up other readings, of course. But the incredible thing was the layering of the birthplaces of all these soldiers, these young soldiers that went from all of these towns out into the world wars. But it was also the fact that you were able to embody those within the bigger names that were the places where the battles fought and where they died. So that was an incredible graphic ability that happened through, really, the skill of these extraordinary designers.
Andrea Goldsmith, we might bring you into the conversation now. You wrote The Memory Trap recently, which is a novel starring a memorial consultant. And it was after you were particularly inspired by a work of art. Can you tell us how that came to be?
One day I went along to an exhibition by the artist Cathy Temin here in a Heidi Gallery in Melbourne. I'd not heard of Cathy before this time, certainly knew nothing of her work. The work consisted primarily of a large room. It was an installation, and the room was filled with trees made out of white fake fur and stuffing. Some of the trees were a metre high, others stretched to 4 metres. Some were conical, others were cylindrical, and others were made out of big white cushions plopped on top of each other. I was, the friend I went with and myself, we were the only people there, and I wandered around these trees all very happily until suddenly I was hit with the sense that I was back at Auschwitz-Birkenau, the concentration camp, where I had been 10 years earlier. I had no idea why I should have this sensation. It was very, very powerful. I decided just to leave it, go with it. I would work it out later. I bought the catalogue, went home that evening, had a look at the catalogue, and I saw that this installation, this artwork, was called My Monument, White Forest. And it had been inspired by Kathy Temin, this artist I had never heard of, knew nothing about, Kathy Temin's own journeys through the concentration camps of Central Europe. I just thought, what has happened here? This artwork had worked as monuments are supposed to work, and that really started my quest to look more seriously at monuments, to work out what does make a monument work, that balance between art and message, and most particularly, given that I'm a novelist and a novelist of characterization, what viewers, what people themselves will bring to a monument and how much that affects what they'll take away from it.
You're listening to Weekend Arts. My guests are artist Janet Lawrence and author Andrea Goldsmith. We're talking about monuments. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, do go to my Facebook page. Let us know the memorials that have moved you and why. That's facebook.com/MelanieTateABC. So in your opinion, that particular monument, was that an example of solid memory, the solid memory you were talking about before, of actual memory becoming solid?
What I love about the notion about solid memory is it's a contradiction in terms. I mean, memory's one of our, well, possibly our most abstract of human abilities. So to talk about solid memory just puts a smile on my face, really. I think the idea is that for me, for a monument to work, it must in some way link to imagination and memory, whether that's collective imagination, collective memory in, you know, what a nation decides to honour and to revere and to memory, or indeed at the personal level as well. And as you said in your introduction, we make monuments all the time. I mean, that drooping bunch of flowers that's taped to a telegraph pole marking where somebody died, that's a monument. The plaques that we see on park benches in parks, they're types of monuments. And indeed in our own homes, particularly if someone has died, those that left tend to create little monuments or shrines, if you like, to those that have gone. The point is that the physical structure must in some way connect with and enhance and extend the imagination of the person who is viewing it.
I wonder how it is that you do that. How do you put that memory in? I just think that there's a bit of a paradox here in that in something like a war memorial, in something like the Utoya Memorial that has just been announced recently, there's horror and there's loss there in war or national tragedy. How then do you put this memory into something without being grotesque or without... Do you know what I mean? Is it a difficult thing?
The memorial has to hold absence within it. This grotesque, like the monuments of dictators, are often quite literal expressing, and they're monuments, you know. I mean, they might be monuments to war and call war memorials, but they don't embody any sense of absence or loss or memory. And in a strange way, they don't endure through time because you have to have knowledge of the actual facts of these things, whereas I think a really powerful memorial stands over time because the materials within it are somehow formed in such a way as to embody even personal memory. So a memorial can become even a space for dreaming and reflection.
I'd like to ask you both the most powerful memorial for... We'll start with you, Andrea. What's the most powerful... The memorial that's been most powerful for you to view and get to know?
The impact of a monument is, for me, always on the individual, and it's what the individual brings to it. So that it seems to me... monuments are a part of their culture and their time. They're asked to do almost the impossible. They're asked to remember both presence and absence, I think. They're asked to honour. They're asked to do a whole range of things that are almost... really quite extraordinary. One of the monuments that I really like, it's not my most favourite, but it's one that I really like, is Maya Lin's Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. One of the reasons why I like this sleek wall of black granite that rises out of the ground, and on it is inscribed all of the people who lost their lives during the Vietnam War, the Americans who lost their lives during the Vietnam War. And you walk along this black granite wall that rises out of the ground. It reflects you as well as bearing the names of the fallen, and people lean in and they look for names, both ones they know and ones they don't know, as it happens.
So I agree wholeheartedly about Maya Lin's memorial. It's very much memory matter that you are involved in. Mm. As you move along it, you're engaged in a slow time. You have time for this reflection, time for matter and memory to merge, and as they do in your own reflections into the work, and the fact that spatially it slightly disorients you without you realizing it. And for me, it was a very powerful experience to go and see that work. And also, as you've said, I mean, no longer is the figure a representation of this, because we are the figure in the work. And that's why I think the memorial needs to create a space for the figure, for the human representation inside the work.
Now, sadly, we've run out of time, so I'd like to ask you both finally, what do you think someone should feel at a memorial? Andrea, we'll start with you.
For the memorial to be working, it needs to have you thinking and feeling in a way different and new and insightful, in a way that you haven't actually felt before, and you leave not only more enriched and more knowledgeable, but also a little surprised.
Janet Lawrence?
I think it has to enable you to enter into its being and its meaning. I think it's interesting having that revealed to you, so that it transcends sort of time, that you can go into the time that is there in the work, but it's also existing powerfully now still. But I think it's also that it's the materials that engage you into it, that you begin to ask, what are they telling me? But you have time to lose that separation from you and them.
Janet Lawrence, Andrea Goldsmith, thank you so much for your time today.